Welcome, everybody. This is Linda Joy Myers, and I'm the owner and founder of the National Association of Memoir Writers. I'm very glad to have all of you with us today. And we have our wonderful guest, Sharon Duquette. Is that the right way to say it, Sharon?
It is. That's
correct. Good. Sharon is our virtual book club guest today, as you all know. Her book is her really excellent memoir is called No Rules. And there's a little introduction, and you can feel free to add more, Sharon. So Sharon this is her debut memoir, and No Rules was chosen as a book of the week by Women's E News. That's fantastic, and a five star review from Reader's Favorite, Kirkus Reviews. Kirkus Reviews, folks, is a very important place to get a good review from out there in the larger world. They said, this illuminating coming-of-age account chronicles a young woman's counterculture journey. Duquette's revealing memoir effectively captures the restless disillusionment of many members of the generation that came of age during the 60s and 70s. Congratulations, Sharon. It sounds like your book has a great start.
Thank you very much.
So what we like to do is start with you. First, you talking about what your book is about. You know, I mean, I read the one line there. And your journey from no book or, you know, not knowing if you were ever going to write a book or whatever happened along the way. And then how you got all the way to what looks like a wonderful, successful launch. So let's just start with the seedlings of you wanting to write this book.
Okay, well, I actually began writing this. I wrote this book over a course of 40 years, which I recommend if you're writing a memoir, you should probably do it in a shorter time frame than that. But that's how long it took me, unfortunately. And some of that is because I took long breaks in between.
Mm-hmm.
So when I
that
first
doesn't count.
Started,
we'll take away 10 years right there.
Okay, good. So when I first started writing it, I actually became motivated to write it. I actually just started sort of making notes and stuff. I was going to therapy. I started going to therapy, and my therapist said to me, I can't help you unless we, you know, because you have all these past hurts, and we need to address those, because every time you have a new hurt, it just triggers all the hurts from before. And so she said, I have to help you face those things, and how, you know, what's a good way for you to do that? And I said, well, I write. I like to write, and I can talk about my feelings when I write.
Mm-hmm.
So I went home and I started writing about this time period. And that was in 1980. It was only about 6 years after some of these things had happened. And
that was
and
early.
At the time,
so you would have been in your early 20s then, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Probably like 25, something like that. And so I was just writing it on paper. I was a terrible typist. So, you know, I think one of the things that hindered me from doing any serious writing back then was, you know, how hard it was to actually type words and have them come out correctly without errors.
Oh, right.
So, those of us.
I remember all that.
Whiteout,
and special paper you could erase and all that stuff.
Yes, all of those things that were miserable. Mm-hmm. So I started just handwriting on paper, and I wrote quite a bit on this big pad of paper and eventually threw it in a drawer. Mm-hmm. And then in 1992, I had a friend who was a writer, and I was telling her that, you know, I had started writing this book. And so she was curious about it. And she later told me, she said, you know, there's a lot of people say they want to write a book, but nobody actually writes a book, or they just have no skill for writing. So I started reading it to her, and she said, "Wow, you really can write." She said, "You should keep writing this." And at the time, I had just bought a personal computer, my very first personal computer.
Mm.
It was pretty antiquated at the time, but I started.
Somewhere.
She said, "Exactly." And she said, "Put it, you know, get this all onto the computer and keep writing it." And I said to her, "I said, well, you know, I don't know if I remember everything anymore." And she said, "Well, you know, just get started, and I'm sure it'll come back to you." So my first challenge, once I started putting this down all on paper, was trying to remember the rest of it. And and I'm sure some of you who are writing memoirs right now are dealing with some of that. But I found that the more I wrote and the deeper I got into it, the more they came back to me. That's the thing that really surprised me, was it's like you start to relive those times, and as you relive it, it comes back to you in just vivid ways.
You wake up that part of the brain by using, you know, essential details and verbs and nouns and being in the picture, being in the movie, you know, and hello, there we are again, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, I would play music from that era, you know,
certain songs
that I remembered, I would hear a
lot.
Oh,
my goodness.
Yeah, and music really would just take me right there. So I would sometimes just sit down, starting a new chapter, and play a particular album or song
or
whatever.
Can you name some of the music?
Yeah, I can. I can almost name the chapters that it went with.
Okay. That's fun.
So I wrote about this one song that was very touching to me was by Elton John. Mm-hmm. "This Is Your Song."
Yeah.
Because I had a vivid memory of there's a character, a person named Bob, who's early in the book. That I met out in California when I was young and fell madly in love with. Mm-hmm. And I remember him sitting in a room, and my sister had this album, so she would play it all the time. And he was sitting there, and he was singing along with this song and singing it to me, looking at me while he was singing it. So I assume singing it to me. and that song really touched me because of that. So that was one song that brought me right back to all those feelings and emotions of that time.
And that happened
all the way through the book, where I could play a certain song, and I mention a lot of these songs in the book, the ones that have strong memories or where I can remember a particular incident of hearing that song. And I put those, I included those in the book.
Yeah, I like that. And the books that you were reading and what you were learning along the way. But let's tell the story of what your book is about too. And we're also in the middle of how did you come to write it? I guess we left off at 1992 when you were handwriting.
Right. Yeah. So I started putting it on the computer. I started remembering all of this stuff, and I started spending a lot of time writing it. And in addition to that, I started going to some writing conferences and workshops, where I began to learn more about how to write, because I had never taken any writing classes outside of high school at that point. So I had a lot to learn. And in fact, the first draft I wrote, the one I was describing to you, I think I wrote maybe 120 pages before I scrapped the whole thing and started over completely.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was a very good reference, because it had a lot of memories in it that I used when I did rewrite.
That's handy to have, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was. Even though it wasn't very well written, it had great memories, so, and great details.
Yeah.
So I began again as I started learning more about how to write. I joined a writer's critique group. That was really helpful for me. And getting that feedback, and in addition to getting feedback all the time, it also gave me deadlines. Because we met every 2 weeks, and every 2 weeks we would turn in work. I mean, you know, you didn't have to, but that was the expectation.
Mm-hmm.
So it made me write on a regular basis so that I could turn in these chapters every 2 weeks. And I did that for a few years, and that was really, really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got up to about the year 2000. I went to a wonderful memoir writers conference. I had also written a piece that was going to be published in another book, an anthology, about it was grandmothers and their recipes, called At Grandmother's Table.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this piece that had been selected to be in this anthology and/slash cookbook. Saw the first pages laid out, everything, worked with the editor. At the very last minute, they decided the book was too long and they had to cut about 10 different pieces in my
head. Oh, dear.
So to me, that was devastating because mm-hmm. that was going to, back then, it was really important to have clips of your work if you wanted to be published.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was going to be my clip to get me to publishing.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So I was very discouraged by that happening. And at the same time, I also was changing careers into project management, and I was taking all these night courses in project management. So I put it aside, and I didn't touch it again for until 2017. So there goes, like, 17 years right there.
Hey, we zipped off the amount of time you were actually writing it quite a lot there.
Right. Yes.
But the arc of wanting, you know, you knew you had, it looks like to me from what you're saying, you had a story that was important to you. And what we talked about in class sometimes was how it keeps chasing you.
Yes.
And that's what happened, right?
Yeah. So I put it aside and I kept saying I'm going to come back to it. And I kept doing that off and on and off and on. And then after a while, I said, okay, when I retire, I'm going to go back to it. So in 2017, I retired. And I had this massive, I had it all printed off. I didn't even know how long it was. I just knew it was like over 600 printed pages. And then I knew it needed a lot of editing, but I didn't know how to get started. So what I ended up doing is of course, by now, 2017, everything's changed. You can take classes online now. You don't have to go places to take classes. The whole publishing industry has changed. Everything's changing over that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I searched around for memoir classes, and online I found this Write Your Memoir in 6 Months class, and it was given by Brooke Warner and Linda Jo Myers. And I thought, oh, this is perfect. This is exactly what I need to do, because it described every class about how all the different parts that they were going to go through, and it also described how they were going to provide feedback to my work throughout the class. So I thought, perfect. So I signed up, and I joined that class.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone in the class was assigned to a mentor who would work with the student. And I was assigned to Brooke Warner, so I didn't work directly with you, Linda.
Mm-hmm.
But I obviously, heard you in every single class
mm-hmm.
as you and Brooke participated in leading the class through discussions and so forth and training. So that class really made all the difference. And one of the first thing that Brooke Warner asked me when I had, we also, part of that class also included a couple of counseling sessions to go over your work and talk about what needed to be done and answer any questions that you had. So I did mine because I already had this massive first draft. I had mine first, and she said to me, well, how many words do you have?
Uh-oh.
I don't know. I never counted. So So she had me take an inventory. She said, go through, you know, first of all, find out how long it is. Yeah. It turned out to be 170,000 words.
Ouch.
You know, I don't know if everyone knows how long a book should be, but a typical book is between like 170 and 100,000 tops.
Yes, exactly.
So I had like two books, even though it wasn't really two books. At first I hoped it might be two books, but it really wasn't two books. So I had to cut out a lot. And so I took an inventory. The thing that Brooke had me do was to take an inventory of every chapter. And in that chapter, you know, say what it was about, and every chapter and every scene, say what it was about and what the takeaway for the reader was. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things I was struggling with in my book is I didn't know what my theme was. I didn't know what the takeaway was, and I didn't know where the end was. So I had 170,000 words with no end.
You were going to write it for the rest of your life.
Probably, yeah. It was just going to keep going on forever.
Right.
And so after that, what emerged as a result of doing that was I realized that the arc of the story was about when I awakened to feminism.
Uh-huh.
And when I discovered as a result of awakening to feminism, finding my own strength, because everything that happened in the book up to then was kind of showing why I needed that.
Right.
All the things that had happened into my life that had created that great need in myself. So,
well, let's talk about those specifics, a little bit more about the story in the book. Thank you for that arc of your journey there. And a lot of people on the line today are in some kind of arc. Maybe it doesn't seem as long, but, you know, some people have been writing for a long time, but they kind of cut off the earlier period when they were first writing because they didn't know they were writing a book. They just knew that they needed to write or whatever. But, you know, I think there's so many different stages. Then there's the, okay, I've really got to do something with this stage, which is when you join, particularly, you know, the six-month class. Also, you'd retired and you had time and space, I'm guessing, you know, for the project. But tell us the story of this girl. I mean, she is quite striking to me. I read your whole book, and boy, did I worry about her. I knew she was alive because she'd written a book, but woo, there were some moments. And so can you talk just a little bit about the arc of that young woman? And really, you were 16 when it started, right?
Right. The book opens... the opening scene is I'm 16 years old and I am dressing I'm piling on all these clothes and putting a long hippie dress over all of them to hide the fact that I'm wearing multiple layers of clothing because I'm running away from home.
Yeah.
And from there, it starts on the journey of how I, you know, go about this. Running away from home. And then there's some backstory about why, you know, growing up in my family and, you know, some of the struggles that my family had and what eventually, you know, the main thing that kind of emerged from that was the fact that I really didn't see a future for me, mm-hmm. that my parents expected me to they had said, well, you can either have a career or you can have a family. You can't do both. And if you're going to have a career and you're not going to have a family, then you shouldn't be thinking about boys because,
right.
you know, there's no point.
Yeah.
Right. So, and I looked at my parents and their life, and they were pretty unhappy. And I just couldn't imagine. It looked like I was being channeled to go on to live a life like they were going to live. You know, they didn't have a lot of money. They couldn't afford to send me to college, and they just kind of discouraged me from even thinking about going to college. You know, if I suggested that I could, you know, perhaps work my way through college or perhaps get a scholarship, they always had a reason why that wasn't going to work.
So you were really sick of being at home, and so what did you do?
So I left with my older sister. My older sister was 21, and we were very close growing up. And she had already left home at that point in time. And I basically convinced her to leave. And the two of us took off together. I had a boyfriend at that time that was no longer my boyfriend, but he was still kind of around. And he agreed to drive us to California. My sister bought the car and paid for everything. And he was going to go to California, too. So so that's what we did. We all went to California. By the time we got to California, we weren't speaking to him anymore. So it was just her and I. And we went out there. We got an apartment in Venice Beach. And then the story goes on from there.
So you ended up, what year did you end up in California?
That was in early 1971.
Okay.
And so the book covers the next.
Right.
Yeah. The book goes up through mid-1974.
Mm-hmm. So it was really at the height, not the complete height, but still the 70s version of what was going on in the 60s, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right in the middle of it. So what I noticed is that, there's a lot of characters that show up in your book. Both characters because they're different and characters because they're people you met and everything. And so what I noticed in reading it is how vivid everybody was. I mean, there are people who are more to the forefront, like an actual boyfriend or all that, but then there are these other people, and I'm just wondering how you either remembered or managed to characterize all these people, because that's a huge job to do so many years later.
Yeah, well, like I said, I did write a lot of it, in the 90s and even a little bit in the 80s. But there was, because this time was such a huge impact in my life and just so different from anything I'd ever done, so much of it really stuck in my mind quite dramatically. In some cases, I had photos. Not a lot of photos, but I did have some photos. For example, the characters who give us a ride to halfway across Pennsylvania when my girlfriend and I were hitchhiking to see the Rolling Stones. Okay. I actually had a photo of them, so I was able to, very well describe them because they were in the photo.
Yeah,
and
right.
I could see what they were wearing,
really,
and you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, all that kind of thing. So for some of these people, I did have photos, and I was able to refer to those for descriptions. And then other people were just, so important to me that they really stayed in my mind. But I did have at least, most of the major characters in the book, I did have a photo of something about them. So that definitely helped.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So one of the things we were going to talk about in terms of what we put on the website that I want to come back to is how you write this honest memoir without apologizing. And it made me think about, it's so many years later, about your sister or about some of the main characters or about your parents.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of confession in your story about many things that you did, which a lot of people were doing at that era.
Yeah.
But you were also very young. I mean, what struck me was how young you were, which made me scared for you through many, many parts of this thing. So you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Well, at the time, I didn't feel like I was very young. I felt like I knew everything.
Well, we all do.
But it was funny because years later, when I looked back at pictures of myself from that time, I was like, oh my God, I was such a child, you know, and even watching my own children grow up at that age and thinking to myself, oh my goodness.
Speaking of getting a new perspective by writing a book about ourselves, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, as far as like how do you write without apologizing for your past? Well, one of the things that helped me was reading other memoirs. I found that the memoirs that I really appreciated the most were the ones and that I really loved and admired were the ones that were deeply honest. Books like Liar's Club by Mary Carr and you know, Angela's Ashes with Frank McCourt, Wild with Cheryl Strayed. I mean, those were few of my favorites. There's so many. And in all of these books, people really talk about who they are from the inside out. And I think that one of the ways that you do this is if you think of yourself as a character, first of all, and you realize that people need to understand the character's motives, what they're thinking and feeling during that time. Because if you take the reader on a journey with you so that they're experiencing what you're experiencing, including what you're thinking and feeling, then they understand what it is that motivates you. And by doing that, then they can empathize with you, even if they don't agree with it, even if they think that, you know, you're totally wrong with doing these things. At least they're experiencing it as you were experiencing it. And I think by doing that, that's how you convey to the reader, you know, what that actual feeling was all about at the time. And then also by thinking of myself as a character as I was writing, and I didn't do this at first. I mean, as I was writing, you know, when you're actually in the writing process, I think you have to just go deep inside and just pour it all onto the page. And some of the things that I was taught over the years in different classes I took was, don't worry about who's going to read it. You don't even have to keep it in there. Just write it down and, you know, you can take it out later if you don't like it. So I did that. And what I found, though, with people reading it, particularly in my writers, you know, my writers critique group and stuff like that, is sometimes the most painful parts are the parts that really draw people in. Those are the parts that that really connect people and where they get deeply involved in your story. So I think people want to understand others, and they want to feel empathy for others, and they want to experience somebody, you know, what somebody goes through who's different from them. And this, right. And reading memoirs is one way you can do that.
Well, absolutely. We walk, like Mary Carr says, we zip ourselves up in the skin of the person, of the person's story. And one of the, and I know, I mean, you may have been doing great with scenes before the six-month class, but one of the things we spend a lot of time teaching, because it's sometimes a new skill for people, is how to do the zipping up, you know, which is through scenes and sensual details and particularity, you know,
right.
in each scene, the particular details. You did all that very, very well. I really felt like I was, you know, watching the movie, maybe I was watching the movie Hair part of the time, you know.
Well, one of the things that I did get out of your class for sure is when you talked about dialogue and body language, because I had a lot of dialogue that was just dialogue. You know, he said, she said, he said, she said. And then I realized that the dialogue came alive when you started to put in the body language of where, you know, what's
right.
going on around the people as they're speaking. And that was one of the things that I learned that made it, I think, a big difference to my writing. that I got out of that class. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of things I got out of that class, but that's one that I definitely remember.
Yeah, that that's one thing we stress a lot. So then you would have had to make lots of decisions. Tell us a little bit more about your process of structuring the book. I noticed it was each year had its own structure, and it was connected to a certain place as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I really just did it chronologically. And in reality, each year did have a different place. So I just kind of went with that because it worked. And then I left, you know, I left out most of the parts of when I came back home and went back to school and all that sort of thing. There was a little bit of that, but there wasn't too much of that because it was more showing just to get on with, okay, so here I am a year later and you know, how do I handle things now? And it's changed and it's different and, you know, that sort of thing. So I did, I actually at one time had thought about just calling it different sects, like book one would be 1971 and book two would be 1972 and so forth. But it kind of just ended up like that anyway. And I named each chapter for, I gave the like month, the starting month and year and place of each chapter. So that I think allows people to, you know, make sure they know where they are and when, and helps them to keep track of that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was a good grounding device for the reader, me.
Yeah.
And that I'm like, oh, she was there in the last, and now she's here. Oh, boy, she's been traveling again, you know. there's a lot of gadding about, not gadding, but really, really major travel by land.
Yeah.
Not much airline flying. Very interesting. So then the process, though, of deciding what to include, I mean, was that difficult for you? I mean, you had to basically offload about, 80,000 words or something.
Yeah, it was very difficult for me. I really spent, you know, like I said, I had 170,000 words when I started this class with both of you. So I had to cut, but I also had to add to chapters and to scenes and everything where I was missing things or where it didn't come across enough. So it wasn't enough simply to cut 80,000 words because I was adding words all the time. So in reality, I probably cut significantly more. But what I ended up doing is once I had identified the theme, you know, what it was that I wanted the reader to take away from my book, which was, in this case, The Awakening to Feminism and My Own Strength. Once I knew that's what the book really was about, then I was able to go back and start removing things that, you know, scenes and chapters and characters that didn't really contribute to that. And that was hard because it was really hard to let some of those events go. Some of them were very interesting. And
well, you have some articles you can post now.
Yeah.
Back to the where you started, right?
Right. In fact, actually, there's one scene I actually kind of regret taking out with all that's been going on right now about being at a concert in Los Angeles where I witnessed the Los Angeles police start a riot.
Ooh.
and that's a scene I took out, but because it really didn't have anything to do with, you know, leading up to feminism and My Own Strength and all that sort of thing and things that happened to me. But
yeah,
it was certainly a pretty interesting event. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things like that. I mean, some people read this book and say, wow, so much happened. And I'm like, wow, and I took so much out.
Yeah.
If I put everything in there, it's
I know.
Much more.
Well,
but that's what was it, you know, because I think what's really hard when you're writing a memoir, what's very hard to do is that everything that happened is important to you.
Right.
And it's really hard to sort through all of these important events in your life and identify what doesn't contribute to the story.
But that's what your editor helps with you to do with you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I, you know, and then finally I got down to, I think I got down to about 120,000 words and I just couldn't cut anymore. So at that point, what I did was there was a woman I knew who was kind of a more of an acquaintance than a close friend. She was the wife of a friend of my husband's. And I knew that she'd love to read because he was always complaining about how much all she did was read. And she read everything. And I thought, oh, what a great person who would be good to take a look at my book because she's obviously an avid reader. I don't know her so well that she's going to just tell me everything's wonderful.
Yeah.
and therefore she can probably be objective. And I asked her if she would be willing to read my book and help me identify what I could remove and what didn't seem important to the story. And she agreed to do that, fortunately for me. And it took her about a month, and she came back with this chart of every chapter and a rating from 1 to 10 about how important that chapter was to the story, to the theme and
handy.
To the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She also made some notes as she went through it. So that really helped me with the final removal of those last.
The final removal.
Yeah. Yes. Really narrowing it down to those last 30,000 words. And I also just did a lot of editing, too. I mean, some of it was just plain going through and saying, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, next, yeah. I mean, really, I went through so many times just trying to take out individual words and words and words. And it's amazing when you start doing that, how much you can cut when you find out how many
How much better it actually reads.
It does. It reads a lot better when you start cutting out all this
extra wordage. Yeah, I know. Your book reads very, very cleanly, very clearly. You know. So then, I presume, having been with Brooke, then choosing She Writes Press made sense. And of course, this is such a different angle of view from 1980 when you
right
started,
exactly
right? Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, so should I talk about why I
yes,
that decision?
Please go on into that part before we have
questions. Okay, so basically, I mean, obviously everything changed in the publishing industry over the years by the time 2017 rolled around, and then there were some things I learned in that class that I didn't know about traditional publishing. One of the things that really concerned me was that I learned that you generally have about, with a traditional publisher, you have about 3 months to sell your book before it gets backlisted,
right.
At which point a publisher may or may not decide to keep it in print. And typically you sell your rights to the publisher when they do this, and you have no say over the time frame before they can put it out of print. And I'm thinking, okay, 40 years, and then I've got 3 months to sell it, and it's over. I just couldn't accept that. I wanted to have control over you know, the future of my book and what would happen to it. Now, certainly you can do that with self-publishing, but to me that just felt overwhelming, and I was concerned that if I self-published, would anybody read it at all? I mean,
yeah.
I just didn't know what to do with that. So when I learned about hybrid publishing, which She Writes Press is a hybrid publisher run by Brooke Warner, and I trusted her because I'd worked with her for a year, so that was also a good thing. And the model and the company looked very solid. And for those of you who may not be familiar with hybrid publishing, basically what happens is the author pays most of the development costs like they do in self-publishing, but in turn the author receives traditional distribution and a higher royalty amount than you would with traditional publishing. What you don't get is there's no advance, and you're footing the cost that the publisher would normally pay. So that can be a barrier for some authors if you can't afford to do that. But on the flip side, I was able to submit my manuscript without having to look for an agent. You know, my manuscript still had to be reviewed and accepted, and it was, so that worked out well for me, because it's not like self-publishing where you can just say, here's my book, and they'll print it.
Right.
They you know, they select manuscripts based on the quality of the manuscript. So, but the thing that's very different when they consider what books they publish is, unlike a traditional publisher, they don't have to select a book based on how it's going to sell. Traditional publishers, a big consideration, and I've heard this from authors I've spoken to very recently, that they've had wonderful books and the publishers or the agents have said, well, I just don't know where to sell this. I don't know how to sell it. There's no way to sell it. Nobody's going to buy it. And that's not necessarily true. There's lots of great books out there, but they're always looking for something that's exactly like something else that sold really well. So, or a famous author. So it's very, very hard to break in with something that's different. So that was another reason that I decided to go that route.
Those are very good reasons, and as you know, I've done a similar thing. I think that also there comes a time when it's just, it's time to get the book out there and done, and that's another thing.
Right.
Even if you possibly can wrangle an agent who can wrangle a publishing deal, that whole thing can take as much as 3 or 4 or 5 years, you know?
Some of us aren't completely
young anymore and would like to see the book and enjoy the book.
That was a big consideration for me as well. You know, I didn't want to wait 5 years to see if my book might get published.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. So, and then there's more control. You get input on, at least you get some input on the cover and the font and, you know, things like that. So I see that you have a publicist, as I was looking at the book. Just briefly, a little bit, what has the publicist been doing, if you can say any of that, or how do you think it's going, something like that?
It's actually been a little confusing to me this year, because, you know, this year obviously is unlike so many other years. Basically the publicist tries to get your book out in front of any place that they can with contacts and stuff like that. I mean, for me, I did get some national attention, not a lot, but, you know, some. And, I mean, others have had better luck, but I think a lot of it has to do with what you're up against. I mean, part of what happened with me, too, is my release date ended up being the first day that they decided to, that they called upon everybody to black out on social media for Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. So that contributed to, a lot of things that I had to cope with as well.
And I don't. That's such a strange. Well, when you agreed to get it published.
And I don't.
Oh, sorry.
Right. And I don't. And I don't. I don't begrudge that to anyone, because obviously, Black authors have waited for many, many years while many white authors went ahead of them. So I understand that, and I realize that is an issue. But
so when you it
affected me personally.
When you agreed to get it published, it was long before anyone would even guess about a pandemic also.
Right, exactly, yes.
How did you do your launch? How did you do your launch?
I actually still haven't really done a launch, because the launch I was supposed to do was with a bookstore near me back in June, and then they canceled it, and they're supposed to do something virtually, and it keeps getting, they keep saying they're going to do it, they're going to do it, they're going to do it, and it hasn't actually ever happened yet, so I probably should have just tried to do some sort of launch on my own, but I haven't, so I don't know. Maybe I'll do a very belated launch. But I supposedly this is still going to happen. And then I also have another bookstore that's working, that I'm working with to do an event at the end of July. On July 30th, Bookseller in Chicago is going to be doing an event with me and two other authors. And Brooke is going to be the moderator for that as well. So I'm looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, good luck. My goodness, I'm glad we could have you on here. That's
yes, I appreciate that.
Good timing for you, because your book was fresh, but I lost track of exactly when it was coming out. So glad we got you on so soon. And I think it's just really such an excellent book, and I do recommend Sharon's book and Sharon's story. There are many of you on the line that I can see, that some of you I know, who would just really enjoy this book. I mean, if you're, particularly if you're in a certain age group where you were young in the late 60s and through the 70s, and, you know, might have experienced some parallel interesting times. Certainly your book takes us back into history. I mean, the whole thing about the Vietnam War and the draft and what people had to worry about then, particularly the men, and if the men were being drafted, what was happening to the women or the wives or the girlfriends that they were with, and, you know, Kent State shooting. I mean, all these things are embedded if you're writing a book about that era.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and each of us has our own relationship. So your book is so specific, it's also very universal. I mean, it's overtly a book about the era, you know. And then the whole thing about the commune, and what I found ironic is that no rules, but man, you know, all these counterculture places had their rules, didn't they?
They did. the way I describe the title is I left home to get away from the rules of my parents, and what I ultimately discovered was that the rules that were really confining me were the rules from a patriarchal society that were imposed upon women.
Including in these communes where it was supposed to be equal, but that was not the case, of course. And a lot of people who lived through that have talked about that and what that awakening process was. And you also talked about the books you were reading. I loved your list. I read all those books, too. I was a little bit older than you, but, you know, they were like taking a crowbar to your brain, you know. And just opened up doors and windows and ways that you just never thought like that before, and that really came through. Well, let's open it up for questions, Sharon. We could talk forever. So those of you on the line, please hit *6 if you want to ask Sharon a question, talk about the 60s and 70s, make a comment, whatever you'd like to do. Hit *6 and don't be shy.
Hi, my name is Lynn Menon.
Hello.
Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Lynn.
The question I have is about you talking about music. I was wondering, how did you get around writing, I don't know if you wrote the names of songs or specific lines. Are there copyright issues when you do that?
No. There are, so I did not use any lyrics from songs.
Okay.
You can use the song title, and that's not copyrighted. Mm-hmm. So I would mention the title, sometimes the artist, and I might say something about what the song was about. but I did not use the song lyrics themselves.
Okay.
Yeah, because that can get really complicated. I did actually, in fact, there was a couple of spots where I changed it after I had written it, where I thought I'd be able to get away with it. I would use the lyrics from Pete Seeger's Garbage Song.
And
so that was in the original version, and it became impossible to find out where those rights had gone. Like, the last I could track them down is that they had been bought by this person who bought all these folk music lyrics, and then he died. So I couldn't even, I had somebody who was very much into the folk music scene who was looking into this for me through the Guthrie Center, run under Arla Guthrie, and they couldn't track him down. So it was... And then in another case, I'd used some lyrics from Marvin Gaye, and then I found out that this person had bought all of Marvin Gaye's music and was, you know, charging a fortune to, you know, to use any lyrics from there. So,
yeah.
So music is very complicated. I don't recommend it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, you can't use poetry or song lyrics without paying a lot of money, generally, and there's lots of copyright.
Mm-hmm.
Laws, and it's good to look all that stuff up. Good question. Thank you.
Yep.
Anyone else want to come on and speak with Sharon and us about anything that we covered today? Publishing path, the many years of writing, having 170,000 words. Hit *6 and come on the line if you want to. Sometimes people are a little bit shy. Anybody else? Hello. Oops. Hello, Brenda. Somebody's trying to get on here. All right. I guess not. Look forward to your comments or your questions.
Oh, wait. Can you hear me? I was on mute.
Oh, there you are. I knew you came
so
on because I saw your name show up. Go ahead, Brenda.
I'm sorry. So I'm just very, very curious. Can you just give a ballpark idea of the whole publishing process? You said that you have to pay now that I can't remember what the lingo, what the word was you said. Is it like the printing part? What is it that you said that you have to pay now that the publishers used to pay?
If you work with a hybrid press, as opposed to a traditional press, a lot of the things that have to be done, for example, that She Writes Press did is they did a proofread of the entire book. They lay out the entire book. Like, you know, when you see a book, obviously it doesn't look like a manuscript. There's a person who lays out every single page. The design. They do the cover. They do the printing, but you do pay for the printing. They also do all the formats for all the different versions that go online. So, like, for example, you have Kindle Nook and you have Amazon. Mm-hmm. Or you have Barnes & Noble Nook, and you have Amazon Kindle, and you have Google Play. You know, all of those need different formats. They create all of those formats for you, and they upload everything and put them in place. They handle...
Go ahead, Brenda.
Yeah, well, I'm just so curious. Like, are you talking about, like, tens of thousands of dollars?
No.
It's less than that. Actually, if you go to She Writes Press, I believe they... You know, and I don't know the exact amount it is right now because I had a contract with them 2 years ago, so it potentially has changed probably.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to their website, which is, I think it's shewritespress.com,
She Writes Press. There?
Yeah, they tell you. They're very upfront about what the costs are. So
it's several thousand dollars, Brenda. So it costs some money, but as Sharon said, I want to accentuate this in that it is an actual advantage if, and I'm not here to sell She Writes Press, but for the, all the hybrid presses, if they have the most, there's a distribution system that some of them have that are the same as what traditional publishers use, and that that distribution system is worth the money because it gets your book out way more into the world than it would otherwise, and that's one of the big advantages.
Yes, right. No, that makes sense, and that's actually how I want to go. I had self-published four very small children's books with my sister, and it was an experience. We learned a lot, but I definitely want to go. I don't want to go the self-publishing route. I understand it completely. So I was just curious. I was just trying to get my arms wrapped around the
Brenda. You know, it's the fee. I self-publish too, and then I've done it every which way. But the fee is very close to if you got an excellent designer and layout person.
Okay.
Very similar, and an edit and some of the proof editing and stuff. It's close. It's maybe slightly more. And also, I'm not talking about the schlock designers that you find on Google. I'm talking about really good ones. So there are various things, including the cost of the paper. I mean, I once did, in 20 years ago, I self-published, which, that was a long time ago. And I learned about all this stuff, quote, the hard way. But, boy, did I learn stuff I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these things, as you already know because you did it too, are a factor in the cost. And so it's very reasonable for what you get, it seems to me.
No, yes, definitely it seems worth it. And so, Sharon, I'm so looking forward to reading your book. I'm just curious one more thing. So when you worked with them, like how closely did you work with them? Like, I mean, it sounds like it was a good relationship, but
it was a very good relationship. You're assigned a project manager, and they basically go over everything with you. Mm-hmm. One of the things that She Writes Press has that not everyone has that is amazing also is that they have a private Facebook page for all their authors, and people get on there and share information with each other. And I'm talking about authors who have written 3, 4, 5 books are on there answering questions and giving out information and sharing their experiences, and it's a real community, and they help each other. And in fact, the authors that I'm doing this event with at Bookseller in a couple of weeks are She Writes Press authors that are from different parts of the country, but I've met them online, and we've written books about that same time period. So, it's really an amazing community, which is something that you don't get with a traditional publisher. And I don't even know if you get that with a lot of hybrid publishers. So that's something that's very special.
Yeah, it is community-oriented. Yeah, very much.
Thank you so much for sharing all that. That was very
good
helpful.
Brenda.
Thank you.
Let us know what happens. Yeah.
I will for sure. I'm going to mute myself. Thank you.
Sure, yeah. We have one more minute. Does anybody else have a quick question or comment you want to make before we say goodnight?
I did. Can you hear me? Or
Beth. Hi, Beth. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you? I haven't read the book, but I'm dying to. I went to California as a mother's helper at 14 in Carmel, and it just was eye-opening and awesome. And I live in Connecticut, but I long to go back to California.
I live in Connecticut.
I'm from Connecticut.
I'm from Connecticut.
I'm writing a book about also my sort of awakening, and I took a 62-day road trip, and the idea of doing how you did a place and a time for each chapter, and then sort of reminiscing back, just helped me out a lot of what you suggested. So anyway, I wanted to thank you.
Great, Beth. Good
thank
luck.
You.
Yes. So thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, yeah. I love these classes.
No good. I'm glad you're with us. Join us for the next event. And thank you all. Just for information for the members of NAMW, but also guests of Eileen Cronin, we're having a really good, really interesting and inspiring member teleseminar on July 24th. If you all are listed in the getting our newsletter, you'll find out more about that and how to join us. So anyway, Sharon, thank you so much for being the guest today. Congratulations. It was such fun to read your book, and it was so well done. And I wish you the best of luck onward as your book gets more into the world.
Okay. Thank you very much, Linda Joy, for having me here today. I really enjoyed it.
I'm going to unmute everybody so we can all say goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.